From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We open the week in review with a question. Is Congress too old? The average age of a House representative is 57 years old, which is 20 years older than the average American. The average senator is now 62 years old. The current Congress is one of the oldest in history.
The writer Anand Giridharadas argues that too many members of Congress have to be urged to leave the stage. He says there are serious consequences when a society is ruled by people who don't have touch with the concerns of younger adults. Our panel, of a lot of different ages, debated it. First, you'll hear me asking a question to Patrick Coyle, a 20-something political organizer. And then you'll hear Sandy Frankel, a former Brighton Town supervisor. Let's listen.
Are political leaders in this country too old?
I mean, I certainly think so, just in terms of understanding problems, you know? I mean, the top three leaders in the House Democratic Caucus, they're 80, 79, and 79, you know? Did Jim Clyburn and Steny Hoyer have student loans? You know, have they ever been on a high-deductible health plan? As millennials is a dumb, overused word, but I'll use it. As, you know, the millennial generation continues to become a bigger force in electoral politics, there need to be leaders that understand the issues that are facing them and the things that are important to them. And you cannot convince me that, you know, any form of national political leadership really is aggressively making an effort to court those voters.
I think that term limits is something that does work in certain instances, but I also am concerned about the loss of institutional memory and wisdom gained, knowledge gained about issues, process, and as we used to have, the ability for people to follow the art of compromise, working across the aisle to get things done. When the Tea Party came in, there were a lot of young people who were elected to office at that time, and they took a hard line and weren't willing to compromise. And that helped to set in motion what we see today, which is the political tribalism that has people taking stands that really block progress. So there are benefits to having people of a variety of ages, and I can also say, as perhaps the oldest person on this panel, we also can learn and understand the issues that are confronting millennials. We don't have to have experienced exactly the same thing to know, to be empathetic, to understand. So I think painting a broad brush in that way is really not fair. Just as you can have young people who understand the needs of the elderly, the needs of their grandparents. And so we need to keep an open mind about that and actually look for candidates, regardless of age, but yes, seek younger candidates. But regardless of age, people who have a passion for public service, who really come into this wanting to do good.
You know, you mentioned institutional memory, the understanding of how things get done, compromise, etc. Here's what Sean says. I'm less concerned with excess elderly representation than I am with career politicians whose opinions are stagnant and harmful, such as the lifelong Democrats who remember bipartisanship and now foolishly think that it's coming back. So, Sandy, you want to hit that? Sean says what you just thought of, said about compromise indicates sort of a decades-old mentality that doesn't recognize the current moment and the death of compromise.
Well, I think it's really sad that you don't believe that we can have compromise, that we can have bipartisan cooperation. And in fact, we have seen some of that happen just recently. AOC and Ted Cruz have come together on a bill. That's someone who's been there a long time, who's older, and someone who's new and young. And they are bringing forward legislation that both of them believe will be positive.
It's a bad bill.
Okay. It may be a bad bill, but my point is that they reached across the aisle to work together. Now, between now and the time that gets a vote, if it ever gets a vote, hopefully there'll be changes to improve it. But my point is that we have people who are working across the aisle and trying to make a difference. So to the caller's point, bipartisanship isn't dead.
And it's still important.
It, you bet it is.
All right. Real quick, Patrick, and then go ahead.
Well, no, I think that's just the thing, right? It's the ideological sorting of parties, you know, like of the Southern Democrats, you know, finally becoming Republicans. And, you know, one of the best summaries I've ever seen of this is, you know, a joke I saw, which was like, you know, from 1920 to 1992, Democrats and Republicans were playing a board game. And in 1992, Republicans lit the house on fire and the Democrats are still sitting at the table trying to win the board game, you know, and that's how it feels to a lot of younger people. It's really how it does. It just feels like asymmetrical, you know, tactics. And I don't want to use the term warfare, but, you know, it just feels like there's a hard edge to conservative politics that just is not matched by liberal politics at the moment.
Next, a subject known as compassion fatigue. Local physician assistant Shawnee Wilson offers trainings on the subject. She'll work with police or schools or hospitals. The basic idea is that when people spend a lot of time working with others who have been traumatized, those workers can experience burnout, depression. They might stop being able to care deeply for others.
This hits parents, it can hit siblings, it's everywhere. Here's Evan asking Shawnee about a study regarding compassion fatigue and police.
Here's a study published in 2017 in a journal called Traumatology. And the study was titled Empathy, Compassion Fatigue, and Burnout in Police Officers. And let me just quote from their findings. Quote, police officers are exposed to severely traumatic material. This study aimed to investigate whether specialist officers had developed compassion fatigue, secondary traumatic stress, and burnout, and whether these variables were associated with trait and situational empathy, an important factor in retaining victim involvement within the prosecution process. The study also piloted a brief training intervention aimed at educating officers about compassion fatigue and ways of reducing and preventing it. Cross-sectional analysis showed that longer-serving specialist officers had greater compassion fatigue, had greater secondary traumatic stress, and more burnout, end quote. Mm-hmm. Probably not a surprise. In other words, the findings confirm what you might suspect, which is that police officers who've served for a longer time tend to deal more often with compassion fatigue, feel it more deeply, feel that what we might call burnout, deal with secondary traumatic stress. How would you describe secondary traumatic stress, Shawnee?
So what I would say, there's a really good definition from Colleen Figley. She's a researcher out of California, and she really describes it as the emotional residue or strain of exposure to working with those that are suffering from the consequences of traumatic events. And I really like that definition because it's the exposure, the strain, and just the residue of it. And it just stays with you and sticks to you.
So as we talk about police officers, let me open with kind of a broader question on whether you're a police officer or a physician assistant, a doctor, a teacher in a district that has high levels of poverty and trauma in the kids in class. Is it possible to avoid compassion fatigue altogether? I mean, eventually does it hit everyone?
I believe it does. I think because there's an essential like a thing I call about, like we talked about learned helplessness, you know, and we are constantly challenged with ideas or situations or words and rhetoric, especially in this country right now, that what we do sometimes and a lot of times doesn't matter. And I know people can argue with me about that, and I can definitely have that conversation with them, but I'm just putting it out there that a lot of times we are challenged with that notion, and it's really been really difficult to try to convince yourself otherwise or to say that, you know, that's not true. You know, this is what really works instead. But the whole process of figuring that out is really fatiguing, is really exhausting, especially when you really care about somebody or you care about your population or you care about the people around you, all of that.
So maybe, and I don't say this flippantly, more clinically, maybe the only people who could avoid it in those jobs in a long-term work setting would be someone who has psychopathy, who doesn't feel empathy, right? I mean, someone who actually cannot feel empathy for others.
Sure.
But that's not a large part of the population.
Definitely
and
not.
Most people with psychopathy don't end up in those jobs anyway.
Let's hope not.
So we're talking about most people. And so when it comes to police officers, if an organization calls you, emails you and says, come in and talk to us about compassion fatigue. We have we all need to know what it is, how it can impact us.
Mm-hmm.
Let me start with some questions that come to mind for me.
Sure.
What are you most worried about with police officers in this country and the impact of compassion fatigue?
So I would say, that's a great question. So I would say just the idea that there is a shorter reaction time to to listening, if that makes sense. So I'll say it another way. Like if you're on a stop and instead if it was like, you know, I'll say like the change of shift, you know, if you've ever heard of that, like, you know, there's a change of shift time and the beginning of the shift versus your end of your shift. You know, the beginning of your shift, you're hopefully, you know, you've had your food, you're ready to go. The end of your shift, you're ready to get out of there. And if you have a really difficult call, you know, you're already tired from the day and you already have having, you just want to go home. But if you already come, if you tack on compassion fatigue on top of that, it's just going to make you more irritable. Your inability to listen is going to be shorter and it's just going to be a more difficult time, which, you know, if you're dealing with the population might lead to poor outcomes or an outcome that you really don't want or a stop that you, that was, did not go the way that you wanted it to go.
I'm seeing an article shared by a retired officer who sends me this note. Here's an article on a New York Police Department officer dying by suicide, the seventh such death of an NYPD officer this year alone. Mm-hmm. And the retired officer says, "It is compassion fatigue is especially acute when a police officer retires and it all crashes down. Suicide among retired officers is disproportionately higher than the general population. Years of dealing with tragedy built up after 30 years."
Yeah.
Serious stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so if you can't avoid it entirely, if you go train a department, they might say, well, we've learned a lot today, but is there anything we can do? What do we need to be doing here? What should change in departments?
Yeah. So I would say one of the things that change in the department is really starts up at the top, I honestly think. Because, you know, all of these things, like when you have organizations that have the need to control, to not give space and opportunity for self-care, to not give people the ability or the room to make positive decisions for their lives outside of their work, where it's constantly about work and about production and performance or about perception from the community, and that's the stressor, then you are constantly going to have people that are stressed out, overwhelmed. And so really, especially with police, there is the idea of, you know, the older police officer or the police officer that's just been through it all, and it's just they're idolized by their colleagues and their peers. And, you know, they're still out there, they're still doing what they need to do out there, but the idea that those folks are looked up to if they make the least bit of noise. And instead of it being like the norm where you have that person that is idolized for what they aren't doing and they're just making it work because that's what they do, why don't we just now have a conversation or have greater conversations within these police departments where we are talking about having support groups for one another? Or, you know, instead of meeting with a psychologist that when you're having issues, meeting with a psychologist and having debriefs after calls, or just having an open session where people can go in and talk about a call if they've had a really bad call, or making it mandatory, you know, or having more screening opportunities for those that are really struggling. Because honestly, you know, people know when their friends are struggling. Police officers know when they have friends that are really not doing great, you know, and they'll chat about it just like I do in the healthcare professions. Oh, that person's really not doing really well right now. And you kind of shake your head and just watch them burn. Instead, you know, instead say, listen, I really want to make sure that you're talking with a psychologist. Why don't we schedule you an appointment? Or just like, you know, having a screening tool that says, you know, you really aren't doing very well with this specific call, or I'm seeing that you're increasingly irritable, you're not showing up on time for stuff, you know, is there something going on?
We'll close the week in review with an eye on Puerto Rico, where massive demonstrations have forced out Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rossello. The governor was caught on tape making crude, homophobic, and anti-poverty remarks. The question is, what happens next for an island in crisis?
Our guests debated it. First, you'll hear Irena Sanchez, and then you'll hear Hilda Rosario Escher.
My family is in Puerto Rico right now. My father's roof is still undone. You know, there is a lot of issues with infrastructure. There is issue with hospitals. One of my best friends moved from Puerto Rico here because she you know, she had cancer. The surgery got delayed for such a long time that after she had the surgery, the cancer returned, and they never give her chemo, they never give her therapy, they never give her anything. And after she got here with the intention to relocate, because the situation in Puerto Rico is so bad, she had a checkup and the cancer was all over her body. So it's very traumatizing to see that a small cold who will send somebody to a hospital will not be treated, and they will be treated as a cold instead of looking to what really is the cause. Like, there is so many situations happening, and we have such a beautiful community who don't want to leave. They don't want to leave the island. We will feel that we're forced to leave. Everything is for sale to the best, to the friends of the people who are in power right now. I was just recently looking at the news that there was an area in Santurce who is cost more than $10 million and was sold to a friend for $3 million. We need to end corruption. We need to start caring for people again. We need to remember that the 2,975 people who die, that this is not going to be in vain. That we need to change, and the changes start with the people saying this is enough. We're gonna take action, and we're gonna hold accountable the people who are doing this type of work.
Can you cite again the number of people who died?
2,975. Well, we believe that it's more than that. We believe that the original 4,000 count.
645.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, but the official one, which we exactly for these reasons, we do not believe, was 2,875. But we get phone calls all the time. We get people calling us and tell us we have to, you know, bury our family members in our backyard because there was no way that we can take them anywhere. There was no energy, no power. It was inhumane. And on top of that, having the people who are supposed to lead the country, who are supposed to look for help and supposed to care for us, joking about it, saying, you know, do we have any other bodies so we can feed our crowds? It's heartbreaking. Sure. It is heartbreaking. So any individual who can joke with something like that should not even live in Puerto Rico. We don't want him near Puerto Rico. So sure. I'm hoping that he thinks to relocate very, very far away because we will never forget this. Mm.
Issues you see. Yeah, issues you see going forward now.
Well, I think that Puerto Rico has a huge issue with infrastructure. I talk to my sister on a weekly basis, and every time I call her, she says, I have been without water for 2 days, or the electricity. So not only that, but there are bridges and roads that have not been repaired. And with that, you know, the economic development will start. So we need to think about, you know, how can we start new jobs, bring more industries to Puerto Rico? What can we do to attract those industries?
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, that's 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll talk to you Monday.